Hey everyone, thank you so much for tuning into Stoop Kids. I'm Cody Narveson, and you can find me on Twitter at Cody_BH.
I'm Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at Shiitake Harry.
I'm Emily Suey. You can find me on Instagram at Emily Suey.
And this episode was produced by super producer extraordinaire Jason Daphnis, and you can find him on Twitter at Nintendoofus. You can also keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Stoop Kids Pod. And once again, that's kids with a Z. Folks, I never thought I'd be saying this, but what we're about to present to you, what you are about to watch and or listen to, is a conversation we had the other day with the author of Hey Arnold, Craig Bartlett. I feel like I would be underselling it to say that this was an amazing opportunity, that it was a treat to take part in, that it was one of the coolest conversations that we've ever been a part of, but it was all that and so much more, and we are thrilled to be able to share that with you all. So without further ado, please enjoy. This is, once again, our conversation with the author of Hey Arnold, Craig Bartlett. Thanks so much for listening. Please enjoy.
Hey Arnold! Bom, 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 bom.
Thank you for listening to Stoop Kids, a Hey Arnold podcast. This week, we are absolutely thrilled to be joined by a very special guest, perhaps the most special guest. He's written, produced, animated, and created many widely beloved works over the years, though he is perhaps, especially within our circle, most well-known for bringing Hey Arnold into the world. Joining us in the booth today is Craig Bartlett. Craig, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, you guys. I'm so glad to be here. This is going to be fun. And I've got nothing to say except how much I'm glad to be here. Let's get into it.
Awesome. Yeah, let's get into it. The place where I kind of wanted to start is, in fact, sort of at the beginning. You know, as we talked about before this, we just finished up season one of Hey Arnold, our discussions of those episodes. So our mind is very much on the origins of the show, the origins of of Arnold as a character. And, you know, especially with the benefit of hindsight and able to kind of see that process of getting the show running from the perspective you have now in the, you know, as an artist in the year 2021, thinking about that process, is there maybe a, you know, an early detail or memory or like personality trait, anything like that, that you can remember associating with either Arnold as the character or, you know, the show, you know, the framework of Hey Arnold as the show, perhaps, you know, the spark that eventually lit the show's fire, if it makes sense to think of it like that, or did it really not play out like that?
It's really true. I always thought that other people who started their own show probably did the same thing, where they just wanted to make a show where the main character is themselves. And if it's not a human or something, it kind of like can be kind of your avatar. It's the character that you can occupy. And so Arnold was just like, I thought, you know, what was it like to be a child? And what did it feel like to be a child was specifically what I was going for. And I thought, well, stuck in church and there's a really boring hymn is going on. I mean, or sermon is going on. And daydreaming, sitting at the window at school and just looking outside and Craig, you know, and you know, what? And you know, I was really that kind of kid. I was a big daydreamer. And Arnold was my avatar, and it really helped to convince, because I think that's really what the job is of a show creator or a showrunner, is you got to convince everybody. You got to make everybody, this is worth doing. We're going to do this. And so I find that to be very useful. And I would say that to all would-be show creators, have an avatar that's like you can identify with, because it really worked for me. I was talking about childhood to my executives at Nickelodeon. And I mean, the Nicktoons could have been about anything. I chose I want to make an emotional show about what it's like to be a kid. And your ability to convince them that they should get this thing made with you is, I found it very useful to say, yeah, I was Arnold. Okay. In an argument, you know, I'd be like, come on, man, I was Arnold. And it went down like this. And even I'd be completely making it up. It would be, this shit didn't happen to me. There's maybe one or two Arnold stories that are specifically based on something that happened to me. The rest is just us, you know, coming up with funny stuff. And it definitely, all the writers were encouraged to tell the favorite embarrassing thing that happened to them, and we try to make stories out of that stuff. I mean, everybody got to, all the people who worked on it got to tap into what it felt like to be a kid.
That's awesome. That totally leads into my question, which is, I'm really fascinated. You've talked in the past on other podcasts and interviews about how collaborative the show running process is and how it's kind of everybody's baby. So how did the show sort of like transform, right? Like you had an idea about Arnold and who Arnold was and as your avatar, but how did sort of, who else contributed to that and how did their contribution sort of change what the show looked like?
That's a great question. And it's really nice to give props to these people because, you know, 50 people just in Burbank were making Hey Arnold. And that's significant. And if that's part of it, once you've convinced everybody, come on, you know, like, let's make this thing. I also think there's a great feedback loop of everybody, the crew seeing the episodes that when they came back, can't tell you what a lift that is. You've been toiling away for months. And then you see the finished cartoon. You're like, oh, woo, you know, that's what we were working on. And so it started, I built the crew. I had met Tuck Tucker a couple of years before I got the chance to make Hey Arnold. Actually, I met him in the early, when I first started working in LA in 88. So that's actually a few years before. And he and I were both working at Bob Rogers' company. They made theme park animation and, you know, kind of themed entertainment. And Tuck was boarding and I was directing something. And I could see immediately, I just love the way this guy drew. And he was a great guy too, super sweet, wonderful. We became friends because he was such a cool guy. And so when I got the chance to make Hey Arnold, I literally was like, I had worked on Rugrats with Steve and Joe, Steve Vixton and Joe Ansaldobehere. And I had been doing a little bit of art with Tuck Tucker. And we had all come together on Rugrats, really. Tuck was around. I met him even before Rugrats, like I say, in 88. It was 1990 that we all crewed up on Rugrats, but all of us were there. Raimi Muskies was there. A lot of wonderful artists happened to be. It's that kind of cool thing where you go completely random, man. On one floor in Klasky Chupo, all these people are working and seeing each other and walking up and down Highland and getting lunch and stuff. And it's like, hey, who knew that for the next 10, 20 years, we'd be doing a bunch of stuff together. And it's just great. That was the crew, that little core group. And then we just added people after that. Jamie Mitchell came on. As soon as things got real, I made the pilot with just Tuck, me and Tuck and some artists, a couple board artists. And Jim Lang, of course, let's not leave him out of this very important part of the collaboration. But we all came together to make the pilot and just that little group. Then when the series happened and they were going to make, they ordered 20 half hours in January 1995, then we had to add 40 more people or 45 more people. And it first thing we did was we hired Melissa Wunsch, who was our line producer. And then she, you know, they literally built a schedule and a budget with Nickelodeon. We added Jamie Mitchell right after that as a supervising director because he had show running experience. And so he... and I probably most ran Hey Arnold. And Tuck, you would have thought of Tuck. I wanted Tuck to be like the supervising director immediately. And they were like, no, he's barely directed. So he can be your star director and Jamie will supervise. And it was a really good decision. Jamie was a very production oriented. He understood the pipeline in ways that I had no idea. I hadn't done that stuff yet. I'd only been working as a board guy and a director and did a little bit of writing. And so that group I just described, there are many, many more that came on. Clint Bond, who came on to do character design for me, and Brian Mark, who just totally ran layout and background. And, you know, Brian was like a wise, he was totally like the guy to go to. And so we had all those people. I mean, I'm already up to about 10, right? And there's 40 more to go. But in that order, we just added, I made that pilot with Tuck and Jim Lang, basically. Oh, and I shouldn't leave out Steve and Joe. They wrote that script with me. And when we had finished writing the script, Steve and Joe and I then were like the writing team of Hey Arnold. Did I get everybody? Any other names that you're thinking of that you're like, what did they do?
That's amazing. That kind of leads into my next question, which is more about like, so you talked about Arnold as your avatar, but how did you kind of develop and design all the other characters? Like, how did you think through that and their relationships to each other?
Yeah, it was very basic when I started. You know, the whole Arnold Helga relationship was not even evident in those little shorts that I made. You know, she was just his torturer. And it was Lisa Groening who said, why don't you, what if she was really in love with him? What if she was secretly in love with him? And I said, yeah, you're right. That would be the best if she acted like she hated him and she really adored him. And which I actually thought was really true about childhood too. One of the many things about how childhood kids can be cruel to each other is that they can bully the person that they're trying to be affectionate with. And you know, I'd experienced it as a kid. You know, I thought Helga was a perfect, you know, for me, she was all those kind of girls that either I liked and it was unrequited or like me and it was unrequited, you know, just like not, you know, disconnect. And yeah, that's, you know, Arnold was based on that.
Oh yeah. No, I just was wondering kind of how you thought through any given character, like
the rest of them.
Yeah. The design of them, like their personalities. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like we made them kind of in the order that they were needed. When I made those little shorts, I only needed two bullies and it was like, they were just three in a picture. And so it was Helga and Harold. And that's funny because it really was. That's all I knew about them. I'll make a girl who looks really mad and I'll make a kind of a large, mean guy. And they're both going to, you know, knock him. And I hadn't given it any more thought than that. And then when it was time to make the pilot, we got to put that whole squad is in the pilot. You know, that I think of about 12 basic kids. If you look at, you know, if you look at the cover, there's 12 kids, and that's kind of where it's at now. I just like that idea. In my mind, it's funny to have a squad of 12, and I like having a squad of four, which is Arnold and Gerald and Helga and Phoebe. And so you could call that group what I had to make next. And those are mostly designed by me. I think Tuck designed Curly. Hilariously, he designed Curly when we were making the pilot, and he was like, I ran out of ideas, so I just put like a bowl cut on Helga's face, on Helga's head. And so if you look at Curly, it's basically Helga in drag in a black bowl cut. And those, I mean, of course, what makes Curly is the opaque glasses, so you never get to see what he's thinking, you know. And it's true, he still looks that way today. And I love the way this is really fun for me to do Arnold art now, which I am. I made a poster that's going to come out for the 25th anniversary for Nick. And I do this kind of package design for them too. And I really appreciate that. I love having it, me still being the designer if I choose. Right. And you know, of course I delegated 95% of the design of Hey Arnold to others, but that 5% that kicks it off, like, you know, designing that squad for the pilot and, I don't know, some of the key designs of season one. I love that aspect about design, too, where in the comfortable setting of a crew of 50, there's people ready to take even the dumbest little sketch you make and turn it into a design, which I often would do. We made every episode, we would table read the script. It would create the recording draft. First, we'd have a table read draft where everybody read it and played the characters, and then we'd get jokes from that, and we'd write a recording draft with the jokes added and the cuts made. And sometimes if it was a terrible script, it would be very different after the table read. But anyway, my point is, when we were doing table reads, I'd go, well, you know, it'd be cool if in this scene, and then on the back of the page, I'd draw the set and kind of try to do a little layout for them, or a character design. Like some of the first season, well, actually through the whole show probably, I maybe just draw like, what if he looks like this and give it to Clint, you know, or somebody, you know, and that's how we did design. So there was a lot of wonderful, like off the cuffness about it too. And it was super cool to see once we got into season one, character design was being taken over by Clint Bond and Jerry Richardson, the late great Jerry Richardson. Shout out to him. He's a fantastic guy. Those guys would draw, like, there was a big crowd, you know, they had to draw crowds and they had to draw many, many characters. I think the Jolly Ollie Man, I might have done the first Jolly Ollie Man, but probably Jerry and so on. There was a lot of characters that you're just, you know, man, once we got into production, we were doing hundreds of everything. And so I could, you know, shit, getting through season one was like, like a, getting through a maze. And I just ended up going, I guess I can do, I can really concentrate on the writing and the recording of the actors and get it to get a cut out to draw. And then they're going to take it from there. So all these other people were drawing everything else. And, it's kind of wonderful. You know, it's like super flattering to think that your ideas were being made by 50 people. I really liked it. I still do.
Oh, that's awesome. On that sort of note, and you commented on this a little bit earlier, just the collaborative nature of putting together the show and also bringing in everybody's viewpoints and experiences. And, you know, I think one of the greatest accomplishments of the show is, you know, it's very multifaceted, it's very deep, and we're telling everything through the perspective of this child. And that's something that a bunch of grownups are putting together. And with managing those perceptions of, you know, the world through a child's eyes, you know, creating things that are maybe distinct to Arnold, but as you said, he was sort of your avatar. So, you know, bringing in your experiences as well, and also managing the points of view of the members of your team. Did you, I guess I'm curious to hear more about like that balance that you ended up striking. Did you find that to be, I don't want to use the word easy, because we're talking about season one and like you said, it was, you know, a battle in its own right, but I'm very curious about that process. If you wouldn't mind speaking to that.
That's a great question. And if I go off track to trying to answer, bring me back to it. Cause I think it's a really good, a question. It's like you want a bunch of people to filter all their own childhood experiences and their own traumas and weird senses of humor and, you know, personal fetishes and all that stuff. And it's like, can you please like funnel all that creative energy into this episode? And then wonderful things happened because I had a loose hand. You know what I mean? Brian Mark, as I mentioned, was supervising the layout, and he had a bunch of incredibly talented artists. He had Steve Lodgwaite, Hugh McDonald, and Cesar Martinez, just for starters. He had these three guys who were phenomenal drawers. And he'd be like, you know, this section of downtown, Lodgwaite made a map in season one, and he was our most junior guy too. And so he showed up and was just like owning it. And he made a map of, and you know, I don't think we hadn't called it even Hillwood yet, but it would have been Steve and,
is that map anywhere? I'm so sorry. Is that map anywhere?
Steve's. Yeah. I've got a copy of it. It's weird. It didn't quite fit on the Xerox machine. So I've got like a partial, and I bet Lodgwaite has it. Just ask him.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a very good archivist, and I consider myself a pretty good archivist, but Lodgwaite is a master at that. Anyway, he made a map of the neighborhood. We agreed, okay, got that, you know. And I've actually, if you go on my Instagram, in the summer of the first year of the lockdown, I did a couple color maps that were literally trying to continue to codify this world. And that was our approach. We were really realistic about it. I think it's really important to remember that unlike other cartoons, I mean, I'm sure like Gotham or something has probably got a map, and they're probably supposed to know where something goes in Gotham. But most people, I loved it. In the world of the Nicktoons, it was all over the place, man. The Ren and Stimpy was being made in a way where John's philosophy was, every shot, it's like there's a jump cut. And the environments they're in are completely random and spazzy. And Ren and Stimpy could be fire dogs one episode, and the next they're homeless bums, and the next one they're living in a kind of a posh suburban place with a lady. And you're just like, well, okay. And to me, my take on making this show was I was going to make it very site specific, and I was going to make it about that. You know, like I want to show an environment. I was very fond of the like Pippi Longstocking kind of life for a kid where they can go anywhere they want because they have their own agency. They can go do what they want. And so I thought I'd love to make a modern kind of grungy Northern American city that kids can relate to, because I figure there's millions of kids living in these cities. Right. And I thought, you know, we'll have an audience, and people who don't live like that will find it aspirational because it looks so fun. They're out at night, man. And the main title is completely me trying to sell that this is our concept. You know, I have them marching like they're in West Side Story, and then it's like the boys and the girls line up and they're like, dun, 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 you know, that was supposed to be, yeah, man, it's like if you lived in the city and every night it was like West Side Story and except a kid version, that was what I was trying to sell. So there we go. I know I've gone way off topic. Bring me back.
Oh boy. I don't even know if I want to bring you back, but yeah, juggling the different, maybe perspectives you had on hand to sort of, it's your avatar, but it's sort of everybody else on your team is potentially bringing something different to the table, you know?
Yeah. And it's just like, to me, it's like sand pouring through your hands is the time and energy that you have to get these things done. And you're in the time that you got, I'm going to put as much energy as I can into this thing and this thing. And the rest of it's going to have to be okay. And I would look at stuff, and I had an approval process where I would stamp approved by me. So I did approve all the designs and I looked at everything, all the layouts. But often I'd be like, hey, man, they got to just do what they got to do. And they all had great, they had great taste and they had funny ideas. The Arnold is very funny to look at, I think, because of the humor of those people, you know, the men and women that drew those characters and backgrounds and storyboards. Often wonderful ideas would come out of the storyboard. I was just looking at Operation Ruthless, which I posted about on Friday because it was fourth in the order, you know, or whatever, of most beloved episodes from season one. And I look at that and I think Kelly James and Tricia Garcia were the two artists who drew that whole board. And Kelly James is a very funny storyboard artist who did wonderful Helgas. Helga and Phoebe's were just, they were great. And, you know, Tuck did Helga one way, Kelly did Helga another. And I really enjoyed the art that was coming out of that. There were many gags. I forget, there's a moment when Helga gets, it goes very badly for Helga, right? Operation Ruthless was a complete success. How there's a point where Helga fucks up again, and behind her, there's a bunch of suckers on the wall. And I remember going, I can't wait to see that in color, the sucker background layout. And it's, you know, that came right off the storyboard. So the board artists were making funny settings. Tuck Tucker, Sewer King, for example. You know, Tuck designed the whole world of the Sewer King in his storyboard. So it wasn't like Tuck was doing characters in a rough nothing behind him and then figuring background guys would fill it in for him. Tuck designed the whole sewer world. And from storyboard, it could be really leading design, or sometimes it would be like, they play checkers in the park, or they go to some little park and Lotwaite and Hugh McDonald and Caesar build these incredible, you know, sets for this to take place and full of detail, you know, and Brian Mark, who supervised all of them. Brian, he put a huge stamp on what Hey Arnold looks like. He and I both were from Hillwood Elementary in Seattle, by the way. That is why the city ended up with that name.
That's unbelievable. I never knew that.
It's our grade school. Wow. I also went to Syrie Elementary after that for grades 3 through 6.
So do you know what PS you were?
Pardon me?
Do you know what PS you were? Were you PS 118?
Sadly, no. The PS was a romantic way to name the school, which I know is from the borough. The real PS 118, I think, is in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And so, apologies to the real PS 118. I also just no day. I love when it's me too. I'm the radio DJ. I'm like PS 114, PS 115, PS 116. Wait a minute.
That's such a universal experience too. I mean, I remember I've been that kid who's sitting by the radio and waiting for my district. That's why I learned the name of my district. Yeah,
we really did, man. We sat at the radio. Yeah, real life experience. That's what.
So my question is almost sort of the inverse of Cody's, and you answered it a little bit with the really great storyboarding, but how do you, the thing about season one that really surprised me this time around is how realized it was. I had sort of in my mind thought like they really found their footing around season two or three, and you know what I mean? But every single episode to me really encapsulated a lot of what Arnold was doing, not just on the surface level, but like really in terms of like what we've been talking about with like being a kid and learning things about the world and sort of like learning how to cope with that and learning
from his point of view.
Yeah, from his point of view.
Yeah.
How did you manage to get everyone to be on board with that? It's like magic to me, you know? I like you had like 50 people doing this and you know what I mean? I just don't know how you pulled that off.
It was a kind of a cool, I mean, I can only speak for myself. Maybe some of the people who worked with me in those early years, the first couple seasons, two, three seasons, maybe that wasn't as magical for them as it was for me. But I felt a cool, something did happen. And like I say, we watched those episodes together. It was like, we in those spaces, we would kind of make a living room out of whatever part of the building that we had at our availability and try to create a living room and have everybody, like literally 50 to 100 people who were around, gather around a big TV and watch it. And I was like, you know, dude, you can sit, I'm fucking crying. You know, I'm getting a lot out of this, aren't you? And I felt like not all, obviously not all. Some are like, well, that was a stinker you know, it wouldn't be about those kind. It wouldn't be about crying. But like when it was a big one, like the Christmas show, oh man, that's a whole story itself. The night that we premiered the Christmas show at a party. And, I mean, I was just like, this is what I live for, man. We were celebrating Christmas. We finished it just before Christmas appropriately, even though I think it played. No, it did play that. Yeah. We had a Christmas party. It was going to go on the air like next week or something. And, we were very excited. We just finished it. And, we got Mary, our boss, booked a nightclub on the Sunset Strip, which isn't there anymore. All the clubs where we had all those early Nickelodeon parties fucking burned down or something else. Every one of them, you know, that's Sunset Strip. And that's Hollywood is real estate is in constant upheaval. But, we had this big party and it was kind of spectacular. It was like a big ballroom or like a kind of stage space and it had fake snow coming down and, they had really neat lighting, which was very MTV. In the early days when I worked for Nickelodeon, they were an MTV company. And so the MTV style was lavish parties and lots of travel. Those were the two perks of MTV. I don't know how well they were paid, but everybody got to fly coast to coast and stay at like awesome hotels. And there was great parties and great food. And, you know, there'd always be like a great DJ, a shit mixer, all this great stuff, light show. But we were in there and the Christmas party was like, is the snow and there was a big throne and it was empty on the stage. And they were like, you know, where's Santa? And they were like, well, he had a car accident and we're going to have to just vamp for a while till Santa gets here. And there were these two elves that then sat in the throne and kind of squeezed in and they were like, ooh. And I just remember sitting with Steve Vixton. He was just like, man, what a show. The Christmas party was very surreal and I was really upset because I wanted to, show the Arnold, Christmas special and they had not made arrangements for there to be like, why isn't there just a big screen? And we all just watched my fucking show I just finished. And they were like, we didn't make that plan. And so I said, well, where can we show it? And the bar in the basement had a big TV. So I'm like, well, okay. I just announced it. Anybody who wants to see the Christmas show, come down to the bar in the basement. Apparently, and we'll watch the Christmas show. And then, you know, the crew squeezed into this bar and it was the bartender with three bartenders, the two guys and a girl, and they were very tough Sunset Strip bartenders, right? You know, they've seen it all, right? Couldn't be a tougher crowd. And we put on the special and I noticed in act two, as it's getting near the finish, the bartenders had stopped taking orders and just had their arms around each other. I shit you not. They're just like watching it like, what's
how could
happen?
You not?
What's going to happen? And then when it ended, they were crying and like hugging it out. And I was like, wow, man, this thing really worked. this is the stuff. So you know, a long way around to say that was the kind of, you know, that creates a mood where people like to be in that vibe. And I think that's why they, you know, we convinced. Again, the whole job is to convince people. We convinced with stories when we'd finish one, I'd go, well, see, that's why I love the baseball, because at the end, music and design, you know, and storyboarding, Jamie Mitchell oversaw that scene. I remember talking about making a cut in there from when Grandpa drops Arnold off to the end of the cartoon at the baseball stadium. I remember suggesting a cut because we were long. You're always like, oh God, what can we cut? You know, what baby can I sacrifice to get this thing to 11 minutes? And I said, well, maybe we can cut this out of the scene at the end. And Jamie goes, no, this is every shot in this thing counts. And if you watch it, every shot does wonderfully count. And you know, those kind of bird's eye views, and it ends on you're coming out of the stadium and it's the music's swelling to this major chord. And, you know, I was like, after something like that, I'd be like, right, everybody, you know, this is what we're doing here. You know, we're trying to, you know, make you feel all that stuff. It's a great speech. Joe and Sol Behar wrote the speech. He wrote the baseball. And so when Mickey tells him about growing up and, you know, first time I played catch with my dad, that's just Joe. And we, you know, if you look at something like that, if you look at the end of that, it's probably based on a lot of movies we saw. You know, we all were big movie and TV buffs, and we'd just all be like, hey, you know that moment at the end of that TV episode where this happened? Yeah. Wasn't that cool? How could we make that happen? And we would just like dress it up in Arnold characters. But we were, okay, so that's how a lot of that stuff happens. But really through that whole thing, yes, Arnold is supposed to be a real POV. And he's supposed to be going along filtering most of this, especially in season one when I had to convince. I had to make people get it. So I was like, you know, always make sure it's being filtered to Arnold if you can. Helga began to immediately create competition for that. Her POV became really important pretty soon, I'm sure. But definitely in season one, taking Arnold through this journey, screening out if it was too off. I remember telling board artists like, no, Arnold wouldn't do that. I'm sorry. You know, let's just not do this scene. And they'd look at you like, God, I just worked all week on that. But you're like, no, man, Arnold wouldn't be cruel like that, or Arnold wouldn't, you know, be tough like that. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of that kind of where you feel like you're having to trim back the impulses of others. But I think they were great. They really grokked what I was trying to do, and were convinced by the early episodes that were great. There were, you know, some of them I didn't like, but some of them were great. Like I love, you know, some of those endings. I love that whole field trip. You know, Arnold feels bad like at the middle of the cartoon. He's got about 6 minutes to go and he's feeling bad. And I think that's, you know, as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, I love this. I just love what's happening. He goes up to his room. All that saxophone takes over. He's going up to his room, and he's laying on the bed, on the sofa, and really feeling shitty. And I love that. And I was like, we got to do more of these. And I think people, they just got it. The crew felt the same way. And it is amazing. I agree. It's amazing that you can get 50 people. I was very lucky, I think. You know, it was a wonderful creative time, 1995, just like cool stuff was happening. I'm not saying it isn't happening now. I think really cool stuff is happening all over the place all the time. But, you know, we're talking about this.
Man, that's so cool. I think we all kind of feel like Arnold at the end of the baseball meeting Mickey Kaline right now.
Hey, good.
I'm wondering if there's anything that you haven't really been asked in an interview about Arnold that you just really want to talk about.
That I haven't been asked. I mean, I have been the lucky, you know, recipient of a really a lot of questions about Hey Arnold. I love the fact that, like, when you see a great movie and you come out and you're just kind of disturbed and, God, man, this is the kind of movie that I want to, now we need to go have a drink and, like, knock back a drink and be like, good. Wow. What just happened? And let's talk about it. Like, why is this? And I just, you know, that I get those kind of questions from people all the time. You know, people really, that were, struck by it and they want to know, I don't know, like, I'll give you an example. I do love when there is a story behind something and somebody asks me, is there a story behind that? And I'm like, oh God, there is, you know, Mr. Nguyen, I was interviewed, a couple weeks ago, about, the whole Vietnamese community, really loving the Christmas special because of the way Mr. Nguyen is portrayed and how it's his POV for the very first time. They said that ever that, the war in Vietnam was shown from a Vietnamese perspective, which I find that, who knows? I don't know, maybe, but, and how kind of cool that was. And so the question that came out of it that I was really glad to be asked was, what was it like to make that with the Vietnamese cast? We had Hip Thai Lee playing Mai and Bowen Coleman, our old pal, making Mr. Nguyen. And what was that like? And it was so fun. It was fun because Steve had a really neat idea. Steve was a good guy for the out there idea. You know, Steve would come in with some really, you know, from left field pitches. And he's like, it was time to make a Christmas show. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? A Secret Santa in the boarding house sounds pretty funny. We'll get all the boards, a reason to get all the boarders together. And Grandma to think it's another holiday and Grandpa to MC, you know. So you could be like, oh, yeah, it'll be great. But Steve's like, and then what if Arnold has to get a present for Mr. Nguyen and he has to kind of go interview him and find out what he likes. He realizes he doesn't even know Mr. Nguyen. And of course, Gerald's great. Gerald's like, why don't you go ask him? Yeah, just tell him. So Arnold interviews Mr. Nguyen and it turns into that flashback sequence, which is just the coolest thing ever. I mean, that flashback sequence is just wow. And again, like, it hooks people too. You like the kids that were watching it. You guys, when you were kids, it must have been like, wow, I haven't seen anything quite like this before. And so, you know, it was based on that really cool idea from Steve. But for me, as the creator of the show and the producer of the thing, I was like, okay, but if it's going to be about Mr. Nguyen, like, we need to kind of handle that. If he's telling Arnold that he had to give up his own child in a war situation, we better kind of, I don't know, get our story straight. And we should talk to Bowen about it, especially because we see him all the time. And then later we cast Hip Thai Lee to play Mai. But, this should be cool, Bowen. So I did it the next time I saw him. Like, I'm sure we were, in those days, we'd be writing stories. We'd be kind of forming them in our minds for a while while we were doing, God, I would be doing six stories, you know, and so would Steve. And, you know, everyone's kind of, we're all, you know, just talking about everything. So it was cool. I knew I'd see Bowen soon when he came in to play Mr. Nguyen. And I said, Bowen, we want to do a story about Vietnam, specifically about how Mr. Nguyen had to give up his daughter and we want to get the scene we want is with the helicopters picking up people off the roof of the American Embassy in Saigon when it fell in 1974. And he said, you know what? I was there. And I was like, wow, you were? Oh, now I really got to do this story. Alan, you know, we can, you know, Mr. Nguyen can tell this story. And I knew it was a very interesting technical challenge because Bowen has a very strong accent, as you know. And he pronounces things sometimes so difficult to understand what he's saying that I would literally go, okay, you can't say that. Can you say this? You know, like just try to reword the things until we had something he could say in English. And so I was like, wow, man, that's going to be a whole story about how he grew, you know, he'd be raising this girl and he's very happy. But a war came and, you know, I knew I'd have to make a better life for her and I had to keep her safe. And so it was a kind of a hard session. and very super emotional. And so you add that to it, like he's going to be telling this heartbreaking story. And so we did it. It really was spectacular. I have my early memories of recording Hey Arnold. We were in a big stage in Burbank. It was called Horta Editorial. It was a big cement, huge interior with these dusty old curtains that were super long. And in one corner was the Foley stage, like a tiny area with like sidewalk and gravel and like little noisemakers in a box. And the kids were always like, "Hey, man," we're like, "Get out of there, get out of the, get away from that Foley stage, get over here." And anyway, I always remember those early sessions, the baseball speech from Mickey Kaline, just like in the dark. And same with Bowen. It was very dimly lit in there, kind of magical. And, you know, it was great. It was like showbiz too. Like it was this old funky Hollywood stage where you make TV. I mean, I loved all that aspect of it too. I was like putting on my headphones and, you know, making TV. And, but Bowen giving that speech, I was just like, oh God. And I remember crouching down and getting really small because I didn't want my crying to like interrupt the flow. So I remember trying to kind of shrink down to nothing and just be literally a fly on the wall to hear, you know, Bowen tell that story. And, you know, there were many of those. And that was some of the magic we were always trying to make. Like, can we make something that like a performer will just kill? Vincent Schiavelli, who played Pigeon Man. I mean, that's some cool voiceover. And you know, it just, the magic happens and you're just lucky. I'm like, wow, I can't believe it, you know. And that was Steve. I'm sure Steve wrote the Mr. Wynn speech. And it was beautifully chosen words. It never mentions Vietnam. It never blames anybody for anything. It just says, there was a war in my country and I knew there was getting closer. The fighting was getting closer and closer. And I knew I had to keep her safe. And it's a tall tale. The Christmas story is wildly impossible. And Gerald just explains at the end. He's like, "Hey, man, miracle's a miracle. You know, get over it." And Arnold's like, "Huh, I guess so." You know, and you know, the Helga sacrifice. And we just went, it's over the top. It's every bit as over the top as It's a Wonderful Life, which was a real model, an emotional model for Arnold's Christmas. We wanted it to be like, oh my God, there's angels and magic and snow falls on cue and, you know, Lang's music completely reinforcing that with all the really lush, cool soundtrack from Lang. And so, you know, we just, you know, it's ludicrous stuff happens, but it's completely acceptable. It's one of the things I love about cartoon making is that live action TV kind of can't get away with the stuff that cartoons readily dish up. I would just say my rule was, this is magic realism. We're doing something that looks and sounds quite realistic, but it's also never not something kind of magic going on. And the Christmas show is just like a stellar example of that. When the magic happens in the Christmas show, it's because it's really good, man. You know, Jamie directed that, so Jamie needs a lot of credit for that. Tuck and Kelly, and really, in fact, that's right. It was our last episode of season one, so everybody kind of got to work on that. So it's also kind of a best of our board team, and the, you know, everybody knocked themselves out. What can I say? They'd drank the Kool-Aid by then. And we're completely on board.
That's unbelievable. I mean, it sounds like your enthusiasm and the sort of spirit of the show was so infectious that it sort of like transcended your individual. That's kind of the through line for the whole show though, right? It's like that Christmas special is so emblematic of what the whole show is doing, right? Which is like the magic that is possible, right? When you...
I think in your discussion about the Christmas show, I think you guys were talking about Arnold's kind of spiritual journey that he goes on in that story. And I was like, dude, that's a deep cut. Because I don't know how many people really get what Arnold's doing as he kind of despairs. You know, that scene where he and Gerald are say, "Well, I guess I didn't do it." Which, by the way, I wrote that scene. And it's funny too, because we were like, oh my God, he's got to lay all this pipe. He's like, at that crazy government building. And you know, that Mr. Bailey guy, he's saying in that speech where he's like, I'm out of ideas. You know, I guess we failed. And so it has to have that stuff in it. And I remember Steve going, you write it. I also wrote the scene that she says to Bailey on the stairs when he's going to get in the cab. Yeah. And it, again, Steve was like, it's great too. It was a great, all of us working together. Jamie was going, you guys, we need a scene. You know, it needs to be, she needs to make a speech there. That should be a moment that leaves you hanging. And you know, what's Bailey think? You know, and you know how Bailey kind of stops and he turns and it's like, he's going to get in the cab. And so that would be the kind of glue at the end of the of putting the episode together, where we're like, it's got to have this. And so I wrote that one too. But the, you know, Arnold's spiritual journey, just to get back to that, he, even when he's failing to make a difference and he can't, he still has this tremendous kind of like spirit. He goes and lays in bed and he just looks up and he flashes back on Mr. Wynn's story. And I was really trying to make it like, as if that would move Helga somewhere, you know? And it's that connection between him and Helga is meant to be like in Downtown is Fruits, the first time she goes like, Arnold, and you like pull out. And then, did you hear something? Because Arnold heard it, you know? Arnold's in a cab miles away, or he's in the back of the grandpa's driving, and Arnold's like, did you hear something? And Gerald's like, no, you know? And that's like, that's all funny, right? It's all meant to be super funny, but it's also meant to be laying down the pipe that Arnold is literally, this is his show. Arnold's like magically connected to everything. And, you know, sometimes we've failed at that. I'm sure there's plenty of dumb, you know, handlings of how Arnold is kind of like really, you know, he's like a little Buddha. And that's an example. When all has failed and Arnold is laying in bed, he can't sleep. He hasn't even taken off his clothes. He's just laying in bed looking out the skylight like, fuck. But it's supposed to be like It's a Wonderful Life. Arnold's like literally like, you know, broadcasting some kind of good vibe. And you know, he and Helga have some kind of connection. You know, they're soulmates.
Yeah. I can't remember whose turn it is to ask a question. Do you guys have questions? I would love to ask a question about Helga, if not.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you should go for it.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about Arnold, and I mean, selfishly, Helga is my favorite character by far. I think she's the best thing, maybe one of the best characters ever made. just to geek out, sorry. Where did the other half of that come from, right? Like, I mean, we've talked about the sort of Buddhism of Arnold, right? And how he is connected to everything and he sort of wills this this better world into effect. But Helga's sort of like the engine that makes that happen, right? Or like she wants that to happen.
I completely think so. Please continue.
Where did the idea of Helga come from, right? I mean, like, how did that develop? Because I think she's as realized as Arnold is, right? And so, like, were they developed in tandem, or did like you said, she sort of came later?
Yeah, Arnold came first in the sense of who he was. Everybody else filled in their, each character kind of helped fill in the rest of the kind of storytelling tropes that you need. I mean, I really wanted him to have a super cool best friend. Then Helga's and Harold were apparently these foes, and the great suggestion that Helga be actually secretly in love with him. Now it's filling out, and we just kept building our way out from there. But Helga, it was in that pilot, which I wrote with Steve and Joe, in the pilot, it's all laid out. And I love, you know, I love looking at pilots of my favorite shows and seeing, did they get it? Was everything set up in the pilot? Like, Breaking Bad, for example, completely sets up everything the wonderfully at the end of an hour. You're like, I'm in. And it's got all the stuff he's going to have to go through. But in the Arnold pilot, we saw that Helga secretly loved him. Then we're set. We're off to the races. When we got the series pickup, we're like, yeah, there'll be tons of stories of unrequited love, which I was pitching as childhood is about unrequited love. That was just like, a kid lives in a boarding house with his eccentric grandparents and borders, and then it's about unrequited love and heartbreak. And when you know how it is with the cartoons, both Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network were saying that, you know, for kids, the joke is that a small thing is a really big deal. Like, well, you can think of so many cartoons that you love where a kid wants something and it's like it's the end of the world if everything has huge consequences to them because they care, you know. And I thought I was just trying to kind of focus that care in make Arnold be about that. And Helga, man, we were just off to the races. It was like a really funny character. She's kind of unattractive with that monobrow, and she's all girly in her costume, but she's really like an ass kicker. And then we immediately gave her the family, Big Bob. Bob and Miriam, I remember kind of going, I know a guy who's like Big Bob. I can picture that. And that makes sense. He's taught Helga to be a bully and to be tough. And then Miriam would be just as poetic as Helga probably, but like has like thwarted ambition. She just can't. Miriam's been crushed by Bob's will and has given up and turned to alcohol, but has all these hidden talents that could come out. You know, all the Pataki girls are amazing. Miriam, you know, she turns out to be like a great horse.
A rodeo wrangler, right?
Yeah. And Olga has all these talents, you know, and Helga has more talents than all of them. Helga's a genius. And everybody just went off to the races. As soon as we started writing Helga episodes, they were great. Steve wrote Arnold's Hat. That's episode 3A. That's the first half of the third half hour. And it's all there, man. The Helga's in ridiculous quests and the lengths she will go to accomplish her goals. And the fact that it's usually thwarted for our amusement. I think it's really important to remember that Helga was such a powerful character because it was so fun to watch her, you know, crash and burn. I mean, if you look at Arnold's Hat, she literally gets hooked, her fishing pole gets hooked to a delivery truck that drives away, pulling her all the way across the top of the building, and then not letting go of it like she should, and then crashing into a shed and leaving a Helga-shaped hole. So, I mean, she's about laughs, you know? It's very funny to see her comeuppance. We certainly started that way, but, Helga, she stayed pretty true, and that would be my job, too, to go, let's keep her always Helga. Just like Arnold has to always be Arnold, Helga has to always be Helga. But you can see the crazy changes she goes through, and that would be contributed by writers and artists, and especially the writers, you know. Antoinette Stella wrote wonderful Helga episodes. Michelle Lamoureux came later and wrote some of the latter-day Helga episodes, and they're great. And so I really did. I let the artists and the writers make their suggestions. Sometimes it would be like, nah, you know, I don't think that's a good story for her. But generally, they blow my mind. And then you have to add the our secret weapon, Francesca Smith, who took it to the next level always. And I particularly started to just write for her. I go, man, it'd be great if Helga did this, and I'll write a scene for her. You know, let's do Shakespeare because, you know, Franny will crush it. Oh my God, I forgot about that. I wanted to clarify something. My only thing that was inaccurate about the podcast was that she gets credited as a writer. And I just wanted to say the internet makes up some crazy shit.
The IMDb is wrong, huh? Okay, yeah. That's good to know. We'll take them to task later.
If you want, I would love, oh my God, I would love accurate, you know, Wikipedia and all the, you know, I see inaccuracies and I'm like, I actually, because I'm the creator, I can't change my Wikipedia page. So I got to hope that whatever's on there is close to true. And so I would say about the writing and, you know, and everything else too, just look at the credits on the end of the episode, because that's approved by me. And often it would say written by someone, so-and-so. And I'd be like, yeah, they're credited for writing the thing. But when they wrote it, we rewrote it. And I'd be like, I wrote that whole thing, but it's credited to somebody else because that's the deal, man. We hired them to write a story. And so that's why they get credit. And the credit really is, it's accurate end to end. I know it. And so just refer to that. And if you have any questions, just ask me. It's really significant to me. I look at that stuff and I think, yeah, you, you gotta give credit where it's due. And it does, you can see there's a lot of people on there. It takes a lot of people to do it. And some of it, you know, we'd be like, nah. And some of it would be perfect, but everybody contributed to that. Yeah. So yeah, Francesca, that would be, she was seriously 9 and 10. Yeah. And with actors do contribute a lot. Actors do improvise very funny stuff. Dan Castellaneta never finished a grandpa scene without making more funny stuff that we were like, oh my God, put that in this. You know, the actors and Francesca, man, she was such a great improviser and so fun to work with. And the collaboration between us was enormous, but she was an actor and the other people were the writers. And so I think when the internet goes, I think Franny really wrote that, it's like, God damn it. there's a reason why the credits say what they say. And there's a reason why each of those kind of jobs is has its own specific needs. And yeah, everybody wanted to be a writer. I love that I've been a writer all these years because it's a desirable profession. People want to be writers. And rightly so.
Oh, man. This has been amazing. I think I speak for all of us here. I know we're coming up on time here. There is, if we could pick your brain about one last thing, it doesn't have to be, it can just be quick. Obviously, you don't have to reveal anything if you don't want to. We've obviously been talking a lot about the history of the show, the origins, what has been, thinking about, you know, what's next coming up. Obviously, we had the Jungle movie within the past couple of years. We've got the 25th anniversary of the show coming up. Is there, anything with regards to the future of either Hey Arnold or anything else that you may happen to be working on right now that you feel up to sharing or revealing?
I'm really happy to say I'm developing something with Cartoon Network, and I'm working with them as a consultant on their 6 to 11 and preschool stuff. And I have loved that gig. So I'm enjoying a period now, which I'm calling hashtag exec life, where I get to be an exec, which I've always wanted to do. I always thought, you know, well, what if the shoe was on the other foot, you know? And I've always wanted to be a maker. I still do. And I'm hoping to, in this relationship, you know, make something with them as well. And so I'm always looking to make new shows. And honestly, it's so interesting how every idea that I've really wanted to make, just be patient, you know, at some point you may. And that would apply to all of them. Arnold, I first created Arnold in what, 88? And it was 96 that it went on TV. That's 8 years. Dinosaur Train, I had the idea for, you know, dinosaurs on a train that would be like, you know, chocolate milk peanut butter to kids. And I had that idea at the, God, I don't know, it was about 16 years before. I literally watched my little boy when he was 3 putting dinosaur families on his toy trains and going, there goes a dinosaur family. I was like, man, you know, you made a show where dinosaurs were on a train. You know, you'd have every kid. And so, but that was like a great, like a really good idea. And I always thought it would be amazing if I got to make it before somebody else thought of it. And so 16 years later, and then Ready, Jet, Go is the space show, like an alien who comes to live on in your cul-de-sac, and kind of set it in Washington State. And make a kind of a NASA facility and have it be about astronomy. I'm sure I thought of that 10 years before. And it's the same with the project that I'm trying to develop now. It's just another one of these that is like something I've been dying to do forever. And I kind of can't talk about it, but I am doing Arnold stuff as well. I've always, always, you know, you can see how much I like it. The reason that I'm always open to making more Arnold stuff, whether it be spinoffs or, you know, some kind of continuation, is because the characters have these huge lives. And I love, you know, my posts are usually just me continuing. You know, here they are. They're still, you know, this is still happening because it's like a real world. And I can see the impact. I mean, that's why, you know, shit, the people who follow me on Instagram are probably 95% Arnold fans. And so, That's what the discussion is about. So I'm always trying to do more stuff. I am working in ancillary stuff with Nickelodeon, and they've been great. There will be stuff for the 25th anniversary that'll come out that I had something to do with. And another collaboration that I worked on at the beginning of the year is just going to hit the market Friday. And I can't tell you what that is either, but in product development and ancillary stuff, I'm staying busy with them. And so there's lots to do. I'm actually really busy right now with scripts and, working in various ways. I'm really happy about that. The pandemic made me wonder, what was going to happen next. And at least everybody's busy. It's insane right now. It's an artist's market again in LA for animation, where there's more work to do than there are artists to do it. And that's the way it was when Arnold started in 95. In 95, it was really hard. Everything was exploding. Everything was being turned on, and there weren't enough artists. And so they could kind of name their price and kind of get a better deal. I think we're back. It's like, this crazy world, and things are just as weird as they could be, but man, they still love cartoons. Not to mention that I, and like all the rest of us, figured out how to do this stuff from home anyway. I mean, this is my office in my house. And, I was already there. We were already like, do we have to come in? Can I just like take the work home and da, da, da? And so animators responded well to the lockdown. And it made me very creative. I sketched like crazy. I was really, one of the things I love is like a Sunday, sitting in the dining room at the table with all the pencils out and a sketchbook and colors and just like, just draw and color all day. And I actually had one weekend after another like that and sort of tried to work during the week. I was like, anyone out there? We were all trying to keep work going with some success. Other places, a lot of people just kept working in animation. I found the pandemic to be kind of a speed bump, and it took me a while to kind of get going again. But things are really busy. I love Hey Arnold, It's the Coolest. I wish that Nickelodeon would say, hey, let's do this or that. And I'm game. I'm up for anything. I love that I'm getting a lot of respect from them about being the creator of it. I think that that's really important. I would say to anybody, any would-be creator, I would say, it's not just ego that you insist that you're the creator and that you're the author. I like that word even better. I'm the author of this material. And I, if you want an answer, you should ask me, because I'm here and I'm available and you can find me. And I'm always amazed when I see, no offense about the Helga writing thing. I mean, you got it.
That's all right.
But when I see something that's like, when Frederator did 105 facts about Hey Arnold, I'm like, shit, man, 30% of those are bullshit. it's really cool to kind of fight that and create as true a document as you can. And I love that. I've been documenting what we did ever since. And it's very gratifying to have people care. It's really a response to people liking it. So that's a really cool feedback loop that I'm just glad it's still going. Can you believe it? It's 25 years now. I mean, I can't believe it's still going.
I don't know. Watching Hey Arnold as a kid and talking about it, with you, with my friends, so many years later, I would not have ever, could not have imagined. But obviously, we're excited to, whatever projects you might be working on, obviously you said you can't say too much about them now. We'll be here. You've got three people here who care a whole hell of a lot. So,
it worked. Yeah.
It worked. It was a success.
It worked. I promise you it will work.
Oh boy. Craig, I cannot overstate how thankful we are to have you here today. Thank you so much again for stopping by our humble stoop, as it were. I guess anywhere that you maybe want people to find you, keep up with you online, social media, anything like that you want to plug?
Instagram. That's the only account I still belong to Facebook, but I've given up on it because it got so weird.
That's fair.
So I just post on Instagram, and it's definitely tailored to the interests of my followers. It's all about Arnold, and I do it. That's just for fun, and then I'll slip in some other odd thing. But really, times are perfect for me. It's in 2021, we're celebrating a 25th anniversary, and I'm going down memory lane big time. And it's super fun. And the thing I love is exactly that. Like your question about what's the question people don't ask. I'm sitting there trying to think, what's the question people haven't asked me about for each of those? And luckily, the ones they picked were, of course, the ones I like best. They did that to me too. You know, Haunted Train, you know, Tuck's first like horror cartoon for us. Those are super fun. And there's something fun. It's like Jim singing that weird "Sometimes Late at Night" song at the end. It's just weird and cool. And I love that you guys think everything kind of really works, because we'd be like, oh God, this is lumpy. You know, that man, that did not work. As we finish something, we'd be like, if we put a sound effect on it, you think we can kind of like convince that this happened, or just some weird, we'd try some solution to that we didn't have enough shots, or and so to have you guys digging it that much, it's the best. It's like, it's really nice. And I love looking back at that old stuff, thinking, what can I show them that they haven't seen? So stay tuned.
Oh boy. Stay tuned indeed. Parting shots, Emily, Harry.
You know, I can't overstate how much the show meant to me. You know, I was 8 years old watching it every night with dinner with my dad, you know, and it's like that meant a ton to him. I'm going to go geek out with him about that right now, you know. And
tell your dad I said hi. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You guys should watch the baseball together.
Oh. Yeah, that's one of my favorite episodes.
This is just a dream come true. I cannot believe it's happening. So yeah, thank you again so much. It's the show has like shaped who we are, I feel. And so that's why we're still talking about it so many years later. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great. Lucky me.
Yeah, to all the bold kids out there who may be listening or watching, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see y'all again very soon. Take care.
Be a bold kid.
I don't know. How does that sound?
I thought that was great.
Okay.
Yeah, that was good. Did we say our Stoop Kids pod?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we got that up top.
Oh yeah. Then that was good then.
And then everything we're saying right now, Jason's going to put in as an outro for the episode anyway. So we've got that juicy content anyways. Okay. Cool.
All right.
Well, nice. Quick and dirty weather.